more at Capterra.com.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah, and I am soon will be joined by my co-host, Ahmed. We're going to be discussing a fascinating study. Are U.S. newspapers biased against Palestinians? We really don't know, but we're going to be talking to two researchers about it. Before we start the show, let's listen to Dalal Abu Amna. Dalal Abu Amna was born in Nazareth, and she has a PhD in neuroscience. Not sure how can she can sing and do neuroscience, but maybe this is why I can't sing. This is Dalal Abu Amna, and this is True Talk on WMNF.org.
Yeah.
Welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah, and I have in the studio with me my co-host. I missed you, Ahmed.
Hi, Samar. I'm glad that we're in the studio together, and I'm looking forward to having the show. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you. There is a Happy New Year, Happy Ramadan, Happy Eid, Happy Easter. No, not yet.
A lot
Easter.
Of festivals, a lot of activities.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Those are all the dates we missed being together.
Exactly.
Because you're traveling around the world, but you look like you had some sort of, it's like a whole, your New Year resolution started early?
It started in May when I wore my braces just 4 days before Ramadan, and I lost since then more than 10 pounds.
You lost 10 pounds because of your braces?
Yeah, because you can't eat all the time, or whenever you want to eat, you have to go brush your teeth, and then whenever they have, every 6 weeks, they go and change the metal thing, and my gosh, this last time it was so painful, I didn't eat for one whole week.
I didn't even realize you needed braces.
That's aging, Ahmed. It has to do with my jaw. It's not my teeth as much as my jaw.
So I'm going to develop
a problem when I am older.
So you're preventing a future problem.
Exactly. So everybody out there, if you notice that your lower teeth are kind of cramming together, that's a major problem that you will face when you are older, like in your 60s or late
60s. Yeah, because unusual to see like
adults
with a lot of braces, but I guess I don't even notice it. But so this is not by design, this is just indirect.
Exactly,
result byproduct
of aging.
Indirect or unintended consequences or intended?
No, my dentist told me that when I am much older, I'm going to develop jaw problems.
No, I meant the weight loss. Is that unintended consequences or were you motivated also?
I mean, for 3 weeks, I'm fasting and I can't break my fasting with rice because the rice goes at every... How can you break your fasting while you are in pain? And you can't swallow, you can't chew. I mean, you can swallow, but
you can't. I didn't realize it was so painful.
Yeah, at the beginning. So I did it 3 days before Ramadan, and I'm sure the two gentlemen that we're going to have a very serious conversation with are thinking we're crazy co-hosts.
Because you're talking about your teeth.
But Usaid and Uwais, bear with us, because my co-host is shocked. I have lost 15 pounds.
I'm not shocked. I mean,
no,
I'm happy for you.
Then I started really doing lots of cardio because I
also went... you became motivated.
I went to my nephew's wedding, Dina and Ziad's son.
Oh, they really?
Yeah. So I had to lose very rapid amounts of weight to fit in my...
Oh, their son, the tall guy?
Yeah, the very tall guy. My whole family is too tall. That family.
He got married.
He got married.
Mabouk.
Nice,
where, in Egypt?
Yeah, in Egypt. So I had to lose more. And now, sadly, nobody's getting married, so I can continue the journey of losing weight.
What does people getting married have to do with your weight?
Because then I buy a dress and I need to go there and look kind of nice.
Okay, so Summer is fixing her Twitter account, but apparently, because she's streaming live on her Twitter account, which she has so many more followers than me, it's unbelievable. But on today's program, by the way, if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5. Every week we bring you the show on Friday from 10 to 11. We talk about global affairs, specifically dealing with the Arab and Muslim world. Samar is a Palestinian American. I'm Egyptian American. And we often talk about these subjects. Today, on today's program, we're going to be speaking to the authors of a report, an article that tracked all the coverage.
Let me, Ahmed, just
about the Palestine, and it seems to be biased, right?
Well, we don't know, but we're going to be talking to Usaid Siddiqui and Uwais Zahir. Both of them are on the phone with us, and both of them are well-known freelance journalists that worked at various different publications before that. And let me just put both of them on the air. And the title of the study is: Are U.S. newspapers biased against Palestinians? We really are going to talk. Let me start with Usaid to figure out the answer. Good morning, Usaid.
Good morning, Summer. Thank you for having us.
Yes, I know. And good morning, Uwais. I know you're there, too.
Good morning, Summer.
Good to have both of you. Can you, Usaid, tell me what prompted this study to begin with?
Well... we started this study because it's a topic that we have followed for a long time. We followed the conflict. We're aware of the conflict. Some of us have lived in the region or in places where the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, people follow it with great passion and are really aware of the realities of the conflict. And I think in general, having followed the conflict for a while, one of the most frustrating things about it has been how Palestinians have been covered in the Western mainstream media, especially the U.S. mainstream media. And we wanted to, with our skill set and our capabilities, we felt that we could help try and bring new light into trying and discussing how the U.S. media, which is the most influential media landscape in the world, tends to portray the conflict, which has also been previously shown to be very detrimental in trying to help others who are not familiar with the conflict to try and understand it. So, yeah, I would say for those several reasons, we decided to sort of pursue and work on this study.
So can we get some facts? Did you cover every single news publications? Did you concentrate on newspapers only, or were you interested in television also?
No, so what we looked at were five U.S. dailies, five U.S. mainstream print newspapers. So the New York Times, we looked at the Chicago Tribune, the L.A. Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. We did not look at broadcast channels. So we looked at the five dailies, and what we did was we downloaded all the articles we could find from 1967 to 2017, hence the title of the paper, which is 50 Years of Occupation. So within that time period for these five U.S. newspapers, mainstream newspapers, we downloaded every headline that we could find and then performed what is called a natural language processing technique to sort of try and figure out what the coverage has been like over the past 50 years.
Let me bring in Awais Zahir, who is also one of the authors and the researchers with this amazing project. How long did it take, Awais, to finish this study?
It was a labor of love, I would say. I think one of the interesting things about NLP techniques is that, with the rise of computing power, it's become increasingly viable to analyze large amounts of text in the manner that we did. I think, just a couple of years ago, it would have been very cumbersome to, undertake research like this. It would have been a slow process, very manual. I would say the actual programmatic techniques are very quick. But what was really, for us, took time was, the actual analysis, parsing out what the results were showing us, sort of really making sense of the trends that we observed. And indeed, what we did notice, I think, in terms of broad trends, was that, yes, there definitely is a bias in terms of the sentiment of the headlines. So we were looking at, headlines which only mentioned Palestine versus headlines which only mentioned Israel. And so there's definitely a sentimental bias, but then moreover, we were able to model the topics that these headlines sort of exhibited. And again, we saw a number of trends, which I think clearly showed that Israeli concerns are, covered and viewed more favorably or covered in a greater increased detail as compared to Palestine.
Okay, let me just read some figures that I am reading from the study that was published recently. So since 1967, 17,492 headlines were Palestinian-centric versus 82,102 Israeli-centric headlines. So obviously, there is a huge gap between the Israeli headlines versus the Palestinian one. Now, somebody listening, Awais, might say, okay, but we don't know really if the 82 were critical, positive, negative, of the Israeli-centric headlines. So did you look into the quality or the content or the nature of those 82,000 Israeli-centric headlines versus the 17,000 Palestinian-centric headlines?
Yes. So the metric used in this regard was the sentiment of the headlines. And essentially what that does is it looks at a headline, counts up the types of words that are within a particular headline, and then tries to measure how positive or negative a given headline is. And our results indicated that on a consistent basis across the 50-year period that we studied, Israel was portrayed more positively than Palestine. Palestinian headlines were, on the whole, more negative than Israeli headlines, and that this was a statistically significant result. And by that, we mean that, you know, this wasn't just something which happened in random chance, that the results were robust, if you will, in terms of the findings. There was one exception, which is the Washington Post, which we were kind of puzzled about, although, again, it exhibited the same trends in terms of positive and negative. The statistical test was inconclusive in that particular case. But I would say overall, yes, through this sentiment, if you will, a measure, a metric, we did conclude that, yes, coverage of Israel, it tends to be more positive than Palestine.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and my co-host Ahmed and myself are talking to Usaid Siddiqui and Awais Zahir. Both are freelance journalists and did a great study for 416 Labs. Maybe they'll tell us what that means. But let me ask Usaid, what about the word occupation? Because, like, for me, I am originally Palestinian. Both my parents and actually my husband were born in Palestine. So whenever I go to places and people ask me about the peace process, they think, you know, it is between two equals and who for some reason will not reach an end to this peace negotiation. But I always tell them occupation, and they ask, what occupation? Did you look, Siddiqui, to the word occupation in these plethora of headlines?
Yes, absolutely. I think that was, I would say, one of our key findings in the study, is that using engram analysis, which Oase just alluded to, what we saw was what words tended to be more prominent in the corpus, in the headlines. And we specifically tried to look for words also that were, let's just say, germane to the conflict, that help understand the conflict best. And when we came across the word occupation, we saw that over the past 50 years, there's been a shocking 85% decrease in the use of the word occupation and similar words to it. And in the Israeli data set, and a 65% decrease in the Palestinian data set. And this was obviously shocking, but because I would say that, and just as you were mentioning, that the word occupation, it in fact defines the conflict in a very neutral way. The United Nations recognizes Israel occupying the Palestinian territories. Even the United States of America, Israel's chief ally in the world, the most important ally in the world, recognizes that the Palestinian territories currently are occupied by the Israelis. And to see that word being erased from, you know, the mainstream media or in any of these mainstream newspapers, to see the word being, you know, consistently erased, is in fact very troubling, because again, like, this is what the reality is. The Israeli state is occupying the Palestinian territories and has slowly and slowly annexed more and more land, and the occupation has only become worse. And so you would imagine that the reporting that you should see should, you know, constantly refer to this word. And as you said, in taking out the word, what it has done is that right now people always assume that there are these two sides on equal footing, that if they just settle their differences, everything would be okay. It's just a matter of negotiating and compromising, when it's not. It's actually on the Israelis to end the occupation. In fact, funnily, I was going through a thread that was discussing our study on Reddit, and somebody was complaining that the study is already so biased. Look at the title, it says 50 years of occupation. And I thought to myself, well, that's exactly what it is. if you don't define it as conflict by calling it an occupation, then you're being disingenuous. And so that finding that how, you know, there's been such a significant decrease in the use of the word, you know, across these five papers is actually really troubling.
One of the things that I was surprised, and anyone can jump in here, is that the New York Times is considered the least out of the five in, for instance, reporting biased against the Palestinians. That was a little bit surprising. Any reason you think, and why, for instance, I think you said the Los Angeles Times... out of California, that seems to some people that California is a little bit more liberal. Like, why the Los Angeles Times is most biased and the least was the New York Times? I mean, all of them are biased, but why this discrepancy?
Well, I can take a shot at that, and I would say that our data doesn't exactly necessarily tell us that information in terms of like the numbers show that, you know, the New York Times would be less negative towards the Palestinians than the Los Angeles Times. But in terms of like why that is, I believe that requires a little bit more research. But I think the important point to note is the fact that regardless of what political spectrum you would say these publications are at, like it doesn't matter whether they're liberal or conservative or centrist, when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, when it comes to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians, they all take a very similar line. They're all more positive. All their coverage is more positive towards Israel and largely more negative towards the Palestinians. And in fact, they are more likely to go to Israeli sources than they are to Palestinian sources, and are more likely to bolster the Israeli narrative henceforth rather than the Palestinian one. So I think while obviously the discrepancy does exist, and it does you know, seem surprising, and I completely, get the question, but I think I would say it's important to realize that across the ideological spectrum, there's just, we see far more favorable headlines and far more favorable stories when it comes to Israel than the Palestinians, regardless of whether you consider the paper liberal or conservative or central.
Okay, we're going to our listeners, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. We're going to stay with this story maybe another 10 minutes. I already have people on the line calling, but I would prefer that you send your email or questions to dj@wmnf.org just for time constraints, dj@wmnf.org. But I'm going to take these phone calls. Let me go to Stephen in St. Pete. Steve?
Hello, how are you today?
I'm very good. Do you have a question or a comment?
Well, more of a comment than anything. I'm confused. I guess this study goes on the premise that what is written, and you can answer the question for me first, and that what is written in the papers is true or is false. Which premise are you going under?
Did you hear any of you the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think rather than look at it in terms of whether a headline is true or false, what this study really was trying to measure was how, I suppose, the narrative around the conflict has been manufactured and constructed, right? So we'd go into a great length in the introduction of the study talking about, you know, the importance of the language that is used in headlines. Oftentimes, headlines are, say, the primary way in which readership will, you know, encounter a subject. They may not necessarily have the time to read about a complex topic such as the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. So, you know, the headlines are sort of the hook. And so there are lots of media theories which sort of talk about the importance of words and framing, such documents and newspaper headlines in particular. And what we know through sort of the academic literature is that what's used in headlines is important. It has an impact, and it certainly directs, or if you will, sways the reader in terms of how they react to a particular headline.
So okay, and the reason why I asked the question is because it furthers the my next question would be is, you know, either the headlines are true or they're false. or the story is true or it's false. I know you talk about depicting, and I mean, we could talk about white supremacy, for example, the past 50 years of white supremacy. I bet if you did a study on that, you would find that the headlines were negative toward white supremacy. Am I correct? I mean, you could do this study on virtually anything and find out that something is negative.
Well, in this case, what we find and see is that there are two sides to a conflict. One is...
There are two sides to white supremacists.
Yes, well...
Either you're a white supremacist or you're not.
I'm not sure that the analogy quite neatly translates over to the Israel-Palestine conflict.
It's either positive or it's negative.
Well, I think, so the study doesn't just look at the positivity and the negativity of the headlines, right? We also look at the actual topics being raised in the construction of these headlines.
So they're either true or they're false.
Just interject here, because our listeners might get confused that this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm talking to two researchers, Usaid and Awais, about a study about the bias. And Stephen is a caller. And I think if I'm getting you right, Stephen, you're trying to say that if 80,000 Israeli-centric headlines are... are about Israel, it means that they are right, and then the 20,000 based or the 17,000 based Palestinian-centric headlines, it means that they are wrong?
Well, either the story is true or it's false.
No, but it's he explained to you that, for instance, remember the kids that were shot at the Gaza beach, the way the headlines was written, it says died. For instance, like they use the word died, and whenever there is a Palestinian shot, like for instance the medic, the female medic, it says died, as if, you know, they die by natural causes, but not by the shooters, or at this case the Israeli army. But thank you so much for your phone, we appreciate it. I want to ask and I want to bring actually my co-host to the conversation.
Well, Summer, I think what he was trying to suggest incorrectly, Stephen, is that somehow Palestinians are 130 times more violent by nature than the Israelis. Like somehow that it's not the biased media, the media is not being biased, that's not the problem. That by nature, that the Palestinians are, that this is reflective of the reality, and the Palestinians are bad and Israelis are good, and that's accurate reporting, is what he's trying to suggest, that it's a reflection of the reality on the ground. But that's, in order to believe that, that means you basically, you're starting with a premise that somehow that the Palestinians are more evil. Would that be correct, Oais? Did you get that impression, or were you, do you have a different impression?
Well, I mean, evil is a loaded word, but I think what it does show is that consistently, if someone is reading these headlines over a 50-year period or, a 5-year period, a 10-year period, they're going to walk away with a distinct impression that, there's two equal sides, there's a conflict, sure, but, they won't necessarily understand that one is an occupier and one is an occupied territory. They'll come away with an impression, for instance, that there's a lot of terrorism, that Hamas seems to be the only or a key defining aspect of this conflict, whereas I think a more fair and accurate depiction would talk about or reflect the fact that, no, this is not a conflict between two equal sides. There is, in fact, an occupation going on in these territories. I think there is a security element to it, certainly, but far more important, I feel, far more salient to understanding the suffering in the Palestinian territories is not necessarily the security concerns, but for instance the reality of the occupation, that there's a blockade against Gaza, that the Palestinians are unable to move freely within their own territories, that their own lands are being constantly confiscated.
I use the word evil because in a way he was trying to suggest that Palestinians are, he's equating Palestinians with white supremacy.
Yeah.
White supremacy is not a people it's a these are bad people that harbor very evil ideas. So he's trying to say, well, if we looked at the coverage of white supremacy, it's not going to be a rosy picture. Same thing for the Palestinians. So he's starting with that kind of premise. He's equating white supremacy, KKK, with just the entire population, ethnic population, which is definitely, had anyone compared white supremacy with Zionism, for example, right away you would get accusations of
anti-Semitism,
or not even that, not Zionism, just white supremacy with the Jewish people.
Actually,
you would be accused of anti-Semitism.
White supremacy specifically, I would suggest that if you look at headlines before, say, the civil rights movement, you would actually find white supremacy and white supremacist themes depicted very popularly. There are journals today which specifically look at foreign policy issues. For example, the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. If you look at its origins in the early 1900s, it was actually a pseudo sort of journal based on things which are very closely aligned with white supremacy in terms of promoting the white man's burden, etc. So I think there's an interesting little twist there on the white supremacy piece.
Oh, that's a good point.
It's very taboo now, but go back far enough and you'll find very positive depictions of white supremacy not too long ago.
Actually, I'm looking at the September of 2018, the New York Times headlines. It says, for instance, seven Palestinians died in Gaza border clashes.
Not killed.
So they think, they died of a heart attack. And then because of the outrage on Twitter, sending them messages, they corrected it to seven Palestinians killed in Gaza border. Still doesn't tell you who. They refuse. They Yes, Usaid?
Yes. I think, I agree with everything that was just said. And one of the issues that I think consistently we see, and this was, and you just saw with the Great Return March, a lot of this same type of, beating around the bush, we could see all the mainstream newspapers and the broadcast channels do, where it's like they wouldn't, outright condemn or outright call out what the Israelis did to the peaceful protesters, to the unarmed protesters, which was, like people, they're shooting people in the back. They're, outright, killing them. And yet we do see consistently the spin towards how the Israelis were behaving in these headlines or in these stories. So I think, going just to add to what what you guys were talking about, the white supremacy stuff. Again, if you know that a country is occupying another country, you would imagine that anybody who's neutral or anybody who has some nuance or balance would recognize who the perpetrator is and who the victim is. And for, 50 years of this occupation, it's clear that it's the Israeli state that has been perpetrating crimes consistently against the Palestinians. So any objective person is likely to see or should be able to see that there should be more negativity towards a group that has been, consistently, that has for so long been occupying another people. It's the longest occupation currently in the world. And so it would only be, the premise should, if in fact, be that it's only natural to see an occupier be more negatively portrayed. Instead, here, what we're seeing is the roles have been reversed, or the cases have been reversed. So,
if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5. This is Ahmed, and that's Samar Jarrah. Now, Samar is Palestinian-American. I'm Arab-American, originally from Egypt. And you guys, I don't think you're Palestinian, right?
No, we're Pakistanis, actually, both of us.
You're both Pakistani.
Canadian Pakistanis, although I personally grew up in Bahrain, so I'm familiar with that part of the world. Very.
But both of you are not ethnically, Palestinian or Arab. Why did you guys choose to study this? Not that you have to be, but have you been following the Palestinian issue for a long time? Why did you decide to do this study?
I mean, I would just say that I think, I think for us, the Palestinian issue, I think, is something that many people around the world tend to be very passionate about. I think you find, especially also in the Muslim world, I think it's an issue that many people take very seriously and many people, very much sympathize with the Palestinian people and their cause, even though their leaders might not, as we've seen that shift in many of the Gulf states and other places with normalization of relations with Israel. But I would say that, you know, I think it's, you know, one of the biggest human rights issues of our times, and I think it's something that has engaged people, you know, for a long time. And I think just having, you know, met Palestinians throughout our lives, being friends with Palestinians, having lived in the region, as Oasis said, he spent like a long time in the region, living in Bahrain. I actually grew up in Brunei and lived a little bit in Pakistan as well, where this issue is, again, you know, many people are sympathetic to it and do follow it. So I would say those were, you know, some of the reasons. And of course, we've been living also here in Canada. We both came to Canada when we were 18 for school, and, you know, we follow, you know, American news as well, Canadian news as well, and we find that a lot of the coverage that we see in general of, you know, the Muslim world and specifically the Palestinian issue as well is very biased and can also, you know, really derail reality, if I can say so. And so, you know, all those things sort of helped us, you know, get to this point in which we were motivated to conduct this study.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. We're speaking to the authors of a report on the coverage of Palestine by major U.S. newspapers. They looked at articles, 100,000 articles, and basically they told us what we already know, Samar.
Exactly,
that
yeah.
Coverage in the U.S. against Palestine or on Palestine, Israel, when you compare the two, it's very, very biased. And no wonder so many Americans are confused about what's happening there because of these headlines. Sure, sometimes even when they report incidents, they report it completely different ways and they don't provide that context. What was the reaction? What has been the reaction from these newspapers to your study, from the New York Times, from the LA Times, from the different newspapers that you had written about? And what's the response from the public?
Deafening silence, I would say, from the five I think papers in question. But I think overall, you know, the Twitter sphere, more broadly speaking, the study is being shared. It has generated lots of comments. I think people are engaging with the work, and I think it really does contribute in a quantitative fashion, sort of adds to what I think a lot of people have sort of known qualitatively to be true. So, you know, now we have some numbers to back up the argument that, look, there is a bias and we can actually trend and chart and, you know, quantify this bias. You know, an 83% drop in the word occupation over a 50-year period is significant. Similarly, the drop in the number of headlines after the so-called, you know, Oslo peace agreement is significant. And I think this study really does sort of add valuable data in that direction. And I think then what we are really hoping to see is people sort of utilize these metrics going forward in crafting better arguments to sort of, you know, hold those in power to account.
If you actually want to see the whole report, you can go to 416labs.com, 416labs.com. Is that in reference to your area code?
That is right.
See, I picked that up,
you
know, because I know that Toronto is a 416. I just figured.
Oh my gosh, you're so smart, Ahmed Yani. What can I do without you? Like the whole year, I came to the studio and never knew what to do. You know, like the whole time thinking, oh gosh, I have one whole hour on the air to fill, and my smart Ahmed is not there. But Usaid, I wanted to ask you, since Trump became president, major developments happening. For instance, moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Stop funding UNRWA, and actually in the Congress we have Rashida Tlaib, the first Palestinian. Did the coverage change because of these developments, or they're still the same way?
So the data that we looked at sort of was just towards the end of, towards the middle of 2017. So in terms of the latest data, I wouldn't necessarily be able to comment, but I mean, what we have seen is that, you know, I would like, you know, as dire as the media coverage in general is of the Palestinians, I would say that, you know, somewhat in recent years or in the last couple of years, that there has been a little bit more focus. There has been, you know, with much of the mainstream media taking on Trump and, largely being very critical of a lot of things that he's been doing. We have seen somewhat, at times the media sort of critically looking at the conflict vis-a-vis how Trump is behaving. I mean, for example, the American embassy move was something that was panned across the mainstream media. People thought that that would be... many pundits, regular pundits who usually tend to be more pro-Israel, so thought that was a very bad move because it sort of undermined American diplomacy, undermined American neutrality, which in my opinion never really existed. But, you know, for some people the bar is somewhat a lot lower. And so I think what we have seen, like, you know, slowly and slowly with more people on social media able to clarify facts and stuff, over time, like in the past couple of years, and especially since Trump has come in, we have seen that the coverage has become, a little bit more nuanced. But I would say that, you know, it's not, you know, but what our study also shows is that, you know, even if we see the coverage is, whether it was, you know, years before Trump or after Trump, it's not like, you know, it's not because of Trump that things have necessarily changed. But I think they are taking a little bit more of a critical look in light of how Trump has behaved, whether domestically or internationally. So I would say that my guess would be that it has become slightly a bit more critical.
Okay. I would like really to thank you, Usaid Siddiqui and Awais Zahir, for being on True Talk. And again, the study is called Are U.S. Newspapers Biased Against Palestinians? Analysis of 100,000 Headlines Say Yes. And you can read it if you go to palestinesquare.com. Palestinesquare.com. I want to thank you, gentlemen, for being on True Talk.
Thank you very much for having us.
It was our pleasure, and I have in the studio with me my co-host. I just read while driving up here 100 miles, Ahmed, that there is a press conference coming.
Today we're actually holding a press conference at the mosque locally.
Oh my gosh, and you sacrificed that to come to the studio?
No, I didn't. I didn't sacrifice, but I am really busy. Okay. But the press conference, basically the Muslim community here locally is... gathering their resources to help the federal workers in the area that are impacted by the government shutdown. So today at noon, we're holding a press conference at the mosque, Islamic Society of Tampa Bay area on Sly Avenue, to announce the details of the program, which I can't share right now, but because they'll, you know, then the press won't show up. So it's what they call embargoed until the press conference.
You have a lot of DC lingo these days that you go there. I'm gonna I have several emails that I didn't pay attention to, but there is this email that says, I have been in the country for more than 6 years and I have never heard the word occupation in any media outlet in the US. How can average people like me play a role in changing the current coverage of the Palestinian conflict in mainstream media? I am sure that you can spread the information, spread the more knowledge, and then...
How about contacting the media and just saying, why aren't you not... Like, whenever you see an article about Israel or Palestine, and they don't provide the occupation context in there, pick up the phone, call the editor, send a letter to the editor, complain to them, say you're not providing accurate coverage. Because oftentimes, I mean, that's the way to do it.
Here is Karen from cyberspace. She sends me this, Ahmed, very interesting. She says, I quote, I don't like this sentence in my daughter's homework reading. And here is the headline. Conflicting perspectives of the Holy Land. After the 1973 war, the Palestinians emerged as Israel's principal opponent. I agree with you, Karen, because Holy Land, like holy to whom exactly? So this by itself is interesting. And then after the 1973 war, the Palestinians emerged as Israel's principal opponent, as if the problem did not start before that in 1948 or 1967 or 1956. So it's like, I agree with you, such a confusing headline. Also, another thing that we didn't get a chance to discuss is that legally and according to international law, the law is on the side of Palestinians, believe it or not, when it comes to occupation, to the status of Jerusalem, to refugees and to all that. The international law and the UN resolution stand with the Palestinians. Actually, there are resolutions that call on the withdrawal of Israel after the 1967 war from the 1967 areas which are now totally under Israeli occupation. So thank you, Karen. Maybe you can call the school and tell them if it's conflicting perspectives, how about bringing Palestinians to address the issues or just ask them. So Ahmed, you have been in Washington recently. Anything going on there?
I attended the swearing-in ceremonies at the first two Muslim women in Congress. Very exciting. They're getting a lot of coverage, as you can see, from the news, from, you know, Rashida Tlaib. She got, you know, there was a lot of coverage about what she said on her swearing-in day.
Yeah, oh, God. Were you calling, there at that
time? Yeah, I was there when I heard when she said it. When she called,
you know, lots of Arab Americans and Palestinians and Muslims tell me she shouldn't have said that, and I said, yeah, of course she shouldn't have said that.
Nobody's saying she should have said it, but in the great scheme of things, in the priorities, and you know what Trump has been doing, you know, the criminality or the obstruction and so many things, it pales in comparison. So I felt like the people that were criticizing Rashida were being unfair, because sure, she shouldn't have said it, but it happened, and we should hold Trump accountable, not be distracted. Yeah. So I think she was kind of disappointed that it created a distraction, but at the same time...
A lesson for her, I think.
Well, no, I mean, I think she, at least, you know, so many of these members of Congress go to Congress, nobody even hears their name.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, this is an unintended consequence that she became very popular among
it
a lot of people.
It was trending worldwide.
Yeah, because somebody called, you know, there were like some people were finally saying, oh, finally somebody's standing up to this president in a language that he understands, uses. That he uses.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not talking about a saint here. This is a person who's bullying people. And again, it's breaking stereotypes, because the whole stereotype, this is the same president, President Trump. Do you remember in the Democratic Convention, which I actually attended because I was a delegate?
Yeah.
Those were the days. You know, 2016, we attended the Democratic Convention, and the Democrats had this Khizr Khan and his wife.
Yeah,
I forgot her name, I'm sorry. But they came on stage, and he held
the
Constitution.
Standing,
and because they were gold medal parents, because their son had died. Gold star parents, who their son had died in while being in the military. And they wanted to just highlight, I think the Democrats wanted to highlight the diversity. And because at that time, Trump was calling for a complete ban and shutdown of Muslims, etc., and he was being anti-Muslim, so they were bringing all these diverse Americans. Well, after they spoke, and he challenged Trump and saying, read the Constitution, Trump's response was, well, his wife was standing there, she didn't say a word, maybe she's probably not allowed to speak. Well, then here comes Rashida, not only speaking, but you know,
speaking
very colorful language. Yeah. So she's breaking all types of stereotypes of what people's perception of a Muslim woman is. So they don't even know how to deal with her.
Yeah.
You know, very outspoken, very passionate. And then Ilhan Omar is another one.
Another Muslim.
Another Muslim woman. First woman to wear a headscarf in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there is a ban since the beginning of Congress that bans headwear.
Yeah,
they had to remove the ban in order for her to serve, because to enter the chambers. So she's already making headways, and she embodies so much, because she's half Yemeni, half Somali. I mean, her prominent identity, she's Somali American from her father, but her mom is Yemeni. Who her mother died when Ilhan Omar was 2 years old. So she was mainly raised by her father. She was she came to the U.S. as a refugee via Kenya.
Yeah,
and imagine, she came as a child as a refugee, coming back to Washington, D.C. as a member of Congress.
At a time where the president wants to ban immigrants and refugees.
Not only immigrants, but specifically Somalis and Yemenis.
Yeah, and Yemenis.
They're both on the ban list. She's both, and Muslims, and she's wearing a headscarf. So she embodies so much, and both of them and many others of these young Democrats are calling for the impeachment of Trump. They're saying he needs to be held accountable.
But they are picking also on like the coat and the bag and the dancing of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah, I saw Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in Washington, and people are just infatuated with her, you know. Because one, because she's the youngest.
Yeah, she's 27, you know, she's
28,
29, I think now.
28, 29, and she's the youngest, and you know, people are just, you know, obsessed with what is she wearing, especially the right. They don't know how to deal with her. She's a young millennial. She's hip. She's able to respond quickly. She's really good on social media. In fact, somebody did a coverage that she's dominating the narrative on social media. Imagine.
Yeah. If she puts hi on Instagram, there is 3 million people that say, I love this.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, yesterday, C-SPAN said that she broke their record for the most viewed clip from the House floor. You know, these House floors where they're standing in the Congress and they're just talking and giving a speech. Well, she gave a 4-minute speech. It became the, you know, most viewed clip in C-SPAN history on Twitter. But because the last thing I want to say, I saw a report where basically based on tweets, she comes second to Trump for engagement.
Oh, wow.
In fact, her engagement on Twitter is more than the 5 leading media companies in America combined.
My gosh. So
like more than the New York Times, CNN.
Are you serious?
You know, all of them together, she has more engagement on Twitter than all of them combined, which means she's driving the narrative. She's way ahead of Nancy Pelosi. She's ahead of all the Democrats on both the House and the Senate.
Yeah, so but somebody might ask, so where are these people when it comes to voting?
Well, I think, you know, she's changing the conversation. She's only in one district, so it's not like the whole country can vote for her. But perhaps if she ran for something higher.
No, but I meant if there are so many people who are like-minded and think like her and progressive, why don't we see their engagement?
Well, I think probably, I don't know. Maybe
all over America.
Some people may respond and say, well, if they had Alexandria's and Ilhan's and Rashida all over America, more engagement would happen. The problem is that some of them see is that, well, it's the same politicians, so they don't excite them to get engaged in their districts. The Democrats often are saying basically, well, it's just, you know, they often remind people, well, Alexandria and Ilhan, well, they're just representing their districts. They don't represent the whole view of Democrats because the ideas that are they're bringing is so different than the establishment. But if you look at their engagement online, well, no, they have a lot of support across the nation, not just in their districts.
Exactly. Do you know that we have fundraisings coming, I think, not next Friday, the following Friday?
February 8th, we have a fundraising here. By the way, February 9th, I'm also hosting a candidate forum at the mosque at the Islamic Society of Tampa Bay Area. February 9th at 1 o'clock is going to include a free lunch for the community, for the city, and for the city of Tampa, city council and mayoral races, you know, the race for mayor. Mm-hmm. So all those candidates will be at the mosque on February 9th. That's the day after our fundraising here, which will be Friday, February 8th. And our fundraising is, you know, we ask for people to support our radio show. So
let's see if you know that you are doing the show with me, you can raise more funds like you always do.
Well, but of course, I together.
Last time I was good.
Yeah, yeah. Last time you came through.
Yeah.
I was helping you from remotely.
Oh, let's. Okay. We have a minute and a half to go. You want to announce where is the press conference?
The press conference is today at the Islamic Society of Tampa Bay area. Again, the Muslim community, with, by the way, I forgot to mention, with Syrian refugees.
Okay.
Are coming together to help.
Oh, the Syrian refugees. I thought you are helping the Syrian.
No, it's the Syrian refugees and the Muslim community working together to help the federal workers who are impacted by the government shutdown. So imagine this. These are Syrian refugees that just came to Tampa. They haven't been here for except for a year or two. And now they're already giving back to the same federal government.
Are we going to see them at the press conference?
Yeah, they're going to be at the press conference.
Okay,
they're going to be cooking meals. So actually tomorrow, if for those that are impacted, they can come to the mosque at 5 o'clock. 5 to 7 is going to be a dinner for all family members. And we'll share more details for the ones that can't come to the press conference today. Join us for dinner tomorrow at the Islamic Society of Tampa Bay Area.
Can you give them the address?
Sly and Orient Road, exit 6 off I-4. It's basically 7326 East Sly Avenue, Sly and Orient Road, tomorrow, Saturday, 5 p.m.
Okay, I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and I want to remind them that we're going to be fundraising soon, so they can go to WMNF.org, click on True Talk, and give as little or as much as they can. This is WMNF 88.5 FM, and NPR News should come any minute now.